This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. We really appreciate you joining us on Trumpet Hour today, and our panel of trumpet writers have some big stories rounded up that they're anxious to tell you all about. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Anthony Chibadidwe.
Good to be here.
Joining us from our office in the UK, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Thanks for having me.
Well, on Tuesday, after weeks of wondering if it would actually happen, U.S. President Donald Trump met with North Korean Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un. They met in Singapore for some historic peace talks. And for the Wednesday episode of Trumpet Hour, Mr. Hilliker put together a really powerful report on this meeting and what the main takeaways are. So if you missed that, please check out our archives to give that one a listen. But the dust is still settling on this summit and on the peace efforts that are still underway. And more reports about the aftermath of the meeting are coming in all the time. So we wanted to talk a little bit more about this today and just bring you up to speed on the latest. So for this story, we'll go to Anthony Chibadidwe.
Yes, well, following this summit, there certainly are a lot of winners, but there also are a lot of losers in this. Some have won something out of it, and they've also lost something else. But Russia and China seem to be the exception. They seem to be winning all the way, but we'll get to that a little later. But first, let's just look at the United States, or more specifically, President Donald Trump. The Trump-Kim summit could possibly be a diplomatic breakthrough for him. And Americans have been saying that we want to bring Kim Jong-un to his senses, not necessarily to his knees. So the Trumpet Hour on Wednesday, the listener out there could go back to it and listen to it. And it really does a good job of explaining how successful these diplomatic efforts could be, even though that could be very temporary. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people have been coming out in praise of President Trump, but probably just as many have also come out to criticize him. So without getting into too much detail, he is both a winner and a loser. Now, one of the many things that people have been criticizing President Trump for is that he has legitimized dictator Kim Jong-un. Some people have actually been calling him Chairman Kim or President Kim but he still is a dictator. The other day, President Trump actually brushed aside concerns about Kim's human rights abuses. He was asked about some of those abuses on Fox News, and he said, well, a lot of other people have done some really bad things. President Trump also said that Kim was a tough guy who has managed to rule his country from a very young age of 27, I believe. But this is a man who has tortured and killed his own people. He even had his own half-brother killed fairly recently, and I think that happened at a public airport in Singapore. He was killed with the most lethal nerve agent, and that was done in public.
Right, and since that took place outside of North Korea with a nerve agent, it was considered an international act of terrorism as well. So it was quite a high-profile assassination there.
And apparently he didn't care what the world thought about it. He actually probably wanted to send a strong message to the world that he really has no regard for what the world thinks. And then there's that incident of that American college student was tortured to death. He was brought here. He was in a coma when he was brought here, and he died not long after coming back. So Kim is actually coming out as a real winner out of this, and hopefully his people will benefit a lot from the world opening up more to North Korea. And there are reports from North Korea that some of the Koreans are really going to push for significant returns for giving up those nuclear weapons, and they might end up getting quite a lot in return. Following the summit, the U.S. announced that it would suspend major military drills with South Korea indefinitely. Now, that's a huge loss for the United States, for South Korea, and for Japan. But it certainly is a big win for Russia and China, because they really have been pushing for this for a very long time, just trying to eliminate the United States' military presence in the region and replace it with their own. China has been militarizing that region for a long time, and now it seems like they are now going to take full advantage of the United States pulling out. And we know that that has huge geopolitical implications, and even like it could affect the global economy, because there's a lot of trade that goes through that region. So lots of winners, lots of losers, but I think Russia and China are really coming out on top out of this.
Yes, their goal would be to have the U.S. military presence totally, you know, eradicated and extricated from Asia. So at this point, Trump has not said we would pull those troops out, but he did, as you mentioned, talk about just ending the South Korea U.S. military drills, which is quite a victory for them. So you can see how this would be something that is being celebrated quite a lot right now in Beijing and Moscow. Would you be able to just put this in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Well, like I said, there are some positive things coming out of this from the United States standpoint, and the Trumpet Hour from Wednesday did talk a little bit about that. But what I wanted to just focus more on is just that diminishing influence of the United States, at least in that region, and it being replaced more and more with Russia and China, because the Bible does talk about Russia and China and some of their Asian allies. It talks about them as the kings of the East, and they are going to unite and form one of the most powerful armies that the world has ever seen. And these developments that we're seeing today are just leading up more and more towards that united military bloc that we're expecting to come out of Asia. And we have a booklet that discusses that in great detail, and it's called Russia and China in Prophecy.
Yes, Andrew.
Yeah, I was thinking as well, too, it's pretty much for all of this year and even probably a little bit into last year, President Trump's been in like on again, off again negotiations with North Korea, which must be consuming a considerable portion of his time with meetings with security advisors, things like that, which is also, you could see how that would really benefit Russia and China. They're working to push into Eastern Europe and take over the South China Sea, and the world superpowers been almost tied up with these negotiations for so long that does take a lot of pressure off them to pursue other interests.
Yes, that's an excellent point about the distraction that North Korea really represents. And it's clear that China and Russia are, you know, as you said, benefiting greatly from this distraction, because it just diverts so much of the U.S.'s and the Western world's attention. And that's something that Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has talked about several times, just about how China especially benefits from this distraction that North Korea is. But we'll be sure to have a link to Russia and China in Prophecy in our show notes, and we'll also include a link to an article that Mr. Hilliker wrote earlier this week called Will the Trump-Kim Summit Lead to Peace? Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. Well, in recent weeks, the Trumpet Hour has been closely following political changes underway in Iraq. And that's because the Trumpet has long said that Iraq will become allied with Iran. And this week, some big developments have just set the stage for that alignment to really accelerate. To tell us about this, we'll go to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this week there came out some big news about the movement towards establishing a functioning government in Iraq. With their parliamentary system, you obviously need to, it's not just the prime minister that has control. You need to have the majority seats, and you've got a lot of groups inside this parliament, and they're trying to form a coalition to make one of them rule, or one coalition rule. We did talk about 3 weeks ago when Muqtada al-Sadr became, or was the leading vote getter. His party was the leading vote getter. He was a cleric that did attack US soldiers, but he was largely painted by the media at that victory as being neither pro-Iran or pro-United States. And so it was reported heavily everywhere, apart from the Trumpet, that Assad was a good thing for Iraq in the way that it would pull Iraq out of Iran's, or out of Iran's hold. And yet, as we said, that wasn't and that isn't going to be the case. And the events of this week prove that. Muqtada al-Sadr, he met with al-Mehri. He was the second largest vote getter this week. And he is the figurehead that rules over the PMF, or the group of militias, the Shiite militias that did fight against the Islamic State that became a political party. This is the strongest ally of Iran in Iraq, in the parliament, in the government. And he, Sadr, said that he would never align or never form a coalition with this pro-Iranian group. And he's decided to flip-flop on that, announcing on Tuesday that they are going to form a coalition. Now, they don't have enough seats among themselves to form a majority. They still need another 24 seats, but it looks very positive that they will be able to form a government with one of the other parties, which is going to be far more pro-Iranian than was reported 3 weeks ago.
So this has been kind of a slow motion trend that's been happening for a couple of decades, actually, just seeing Iraq move into the Iranian camp. And I guess I've come to think of it as sort of a fait accompli, like it's already done. Iraq is already in Iran's orbit. What does this change in the government there signify? Like, in practical terms, how much closer could Iraq get, and what would that mean for Iran's power in the Middle East?
Certainly, we haven't seen a government of Iraq that that is as close to Iran as this government will be if it works out. Still got another 24 seats to get. But just to show you how the power has shifted, remember the United States was heavily in Iraq up until recent years. They've still got 5,000 plus troops there right now. Abadi, the former prime minister, he was considered a U.S. ally, and was definitely more in the center when it comes to either the U.S. or Iran, which is Iraq going to favor. Abadi was more in the center. Well, he's not even going to be a part of this government. It looked like he might have been, but he won't be. He was hoping to continue to be the prime minister. That won't happen. And so we're definitely going to see a more pro-Iranian stance. This is something, and to the likes of which we haven't seen. For example, who was over negotiating this deal this past week? It's interesting. On Tuesday, you had the IRGC Quds Force leader, Qassem Soleimani. We've talked about him a lot on this program. He was there in Baghdad negotiating with Sadr and Amiri this pact between the two. This is the point man of the Iranian regime anywhere across the world. They send him and he does the official foreign ministry business. Well, he was in Iraq organizing this coalition, not just him, but also the son of the grand Ayatollah of Iran. He was in the room as well. So you've got Iranians right there in Baghdad negotiating the coalition of the Iraqi government. And they were successful at doing that. There wasn't a United States representative in the room. And so this is shocking many agencies. If you look at all the reporting, this is just one article that came out on it. This is from Radio Free Europe. They said Shiite leaders in Iraq form unexpected pro-Iran political alliance. Really? Really? Unexpected? Unexpected? Not if you've been listening to us for the past 20 years or even 3 weeks ago. We said this was going to happen because this is the way Iraq has gone. Iran is right next door. They're not going to give up the gains that they've made throughout the past few years fighting against the Islamic State, pushing the United States out. And now they're going to make it official with a strongly pro-Iranian government in Baghdad.
Could you put this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and just tell listeners where they could go if they wanted to learn more about this trend?
There's basically all of our reporting in the Middle East regarding Iran and Iraq. We've been talking about this how this was going to happen. As far back as 1996, we forecast that Iraq would fall to Iran. And then in 2003, when Saddam Hussein was deposed by the United States and you had hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops inside Iraq, our editor-in-chief at that time wrote that, quote, "It may seem shocking given the U.S. presence in the region now, but prophecy indicates that in pursuit of its goal, Iran will probably take over Iraq." And this has been, as you said, it's been a slow-moving fait accompli. It's been happening year in, year out. There have been some bumps along the road, of course, with U.S. presence increasing and decreasing, but Iran is there for the long haul. And Mr. Flurry based that prophecy on some prophecies in the book of Daniel. You can read his article. I would just alert you to go and read his article from earlier this year. It's in the January 2018 Philadelphia Trumpet print magazine. It's entitled America's Greatest Defeat, Iran's Victory. That's what this is about. You're going to have an Iraqi government. Who's it going to side with, the United States or Iran? Given how much money, time, and effort the United States have spent in Iraq over the past decade, you'd hope they'd pick the United States. But the representatives are not picking the United States. They're clearly picking the Iranian side.
Well, we'll be sure to have a link to that article that Brent mentioned there, America's Greatest Defeat, Iran's Victory, in the show notes. Thanks very much for that, Brent. The German government is on increasingly shaky ground. Chancellor Angela Merkel is now facing what some are calling her most serious challenge to date. And to tell us about what this means for Merkel and for the future of Germany and Europe, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Germany's government is at stake. Angela Merkel's chancellorship is at stake. Even the 70-year-old long alliance between the Christian Democratic Union and Christian Social Union parties within Germany could be on the brink of unraveling. So German the bust up is, as usual for Germany, about the migrant crisis. The CSU leader, that's the Christian Social Union, this more right-wing party that runs only in Bavaria, their leader Horst Seehofer, he's the interior minister in Germany, and he has an expanded brief to deal with migration. He had planned to put forward his migration grand plan, and his grand plan was basically to completely reverse Angela Merkel's policy. He wanted to put back border controls at Germany's border, and Germany would not accept migrants who had arrived and been registered in other European countries. This is the way it was before Angela Merkel, you know, historically opened the floodgates 2 or 3 years ago and said, we'll welcome everybody in. That's kind of what used to be standard European practice. So he wanted to completely undo what Angela, well, at least shut the stable doors, perhaps after the horses have bolted, but shut the stable doors on what Angela Merkel has done. Angela Merkel said no, she objected to this. Horst Seehofer has now, at least according to just about all the German press and their different insider contacts, said, I don't care, we're going to push forward on this anyway. Angela Merkel has pushed for more time, tried to say, well, can we have another couple of weeks to sort this out at a European level? The CSU has said, look, you've had 2 years to sort this out at a European level. No more time. We're putting this into practice on Monday. Now, if they go ahead with that, basically Ms. Merkel, her options are to fire Horst Seehofer, which would bring down her government, but it could well lead to a vote of no confidence in Angela Merkel. Potentially even fresh elections, at least new coalition negotiations, end of this government, perhaps end of Angela Merkel's career. Or she ignores it and basically shows to everybody else in her coalition, look, you can completely ignore me and not do what I say and get away with it, which may not end her chancellorship immediately, but pretty much destroys all of her authority and credibility. So she's in a really tough position. So now, today, over this weekend, there's going to be frantic negotiations to try and stop this showdown on Monday. But people are already saying, well, Deutsche Welle, they wrote that even if Merkel comes out of this crisis intact, she knows her position within her own party is now too weak to take any more major political risks. They quoted another journalist basically saying, from this day forward, Merkel will be an altogether different kind of chancellor. There are Berlin Policy Journal They said that high-ranking leaders of the CSU described the conflict as very serious. There are rumors of the two breaking their union, an alliance that has stood for decades. That would lead to an historic shift in German politics. They wrote that at this point, creating a compromise that allows both Merkel and the CSU to save face will be incredibly difficult. CSU leaders have staked their credibility on winning this battle months before Bavarian elections in October. So we're looking at a major confrontation. That's significant. And I think the other thing that's significant that we need to remember is we're facing a major confrontation just a couple of months into Germany's chancellorship. So this isn't for sure going to sink the government. They have the weekend to try and work this out. Miss Merkel is very good at patching together compromises, but look how fast we ended up in this position, which is what we've been saying since the election in September, that even if they cobble together a coalition, given the current conditions in Germany, it's going to be unstable. And we're facing kind of we're just 2 months into it, and we're facing the biggest crisis of Angela Merkel's 3 years in power. So, this is not going to be a stable coalition. If they survive this period of choppy seas, how long is it until they get to the next period?
So, infighting, crumbling alliances, fracturing coalitions, possibly new elections. It really sounds like we could see a total sea change in the German leadership coming up soon. What do you think we can expect for the near term and then going forward?
Yeah, it's a good question. Going forward, even if they get through this, we can expect this. I mean, this just blew up in a week. So even if they get through on just about any given week, there's the possibility of meltdown in the German government. I think the Bavarian elections in October are going to be very interesting to watch. This is something that could lead to a big change, even potentially within the Christian Social Union. A lot of their leaders are fighting for their political survival. But to take a longer view, ultimately just German politics as usual is really at stake here. We've got with the Alternative for Deutschland coming up, you've got the left party on the left kind of gaining more and more votes. You're in this position where all the mainstream parties are losing votes, all the extreme parties are forming votes, normal coalitions just become unworkable, and you're looking at potentially just German politics becoming unworkable. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about how even it looks like Angela Merkel herself may be coming to the conclusion that in this unstable world and in this unstable Germany, Germany needs a strongman. People are writing in the Spiegel about that kind of thinking. So I think absolutely that's where this is going in the long term. You've just got this mess of a coalition that is just going to increase appetite for somebody who can get things done, some radical change in German politics. And that's exactly what the Bible forecasts. The Bible talks about a strong German leader. It calls him a king. Trump's editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, has talked about, when the Bible talks about a king, it's talking about an authoritarian leader, a German Putin. And that's exactly where this is leading. Putin arose in Russia out of unstable political conditions there. That's what we're going to see within Germany. Trump's editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, has a book, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. It goes through these prophecies in Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapter 11. In Revelation 17, that prophesy of this strong political leader that's going to arise in Europe. We're seeing the conditions that we see right now in Germany match exactly the conditions that Mr. Flurry has been forecasting for years, saying watch for these conditions to arise because they're the perfect conditions for a strong leader. Those conditions are here. So read that book to learn more about what the Bible says is coming, because it is a pivotal period to watch for world politics within Germany.
A German Putin is coming. That's a really sobering reality just to be anticipating there. But we'll be sure to have a link in our show notes to A Strong German Leader is Imminent by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Mr. Gerald Flurry. Thanks very much for sharing your insight on that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. And most of the stories that we're discussing today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be up there soon if they're not yet. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information on these important stories. We're going to take a break in just a moment, but first we'll cover one more story about a teacher in a public high school here in the United States who was forced to resign because he took a stand on the side of biology. To tell us about this, we'll go to Andrew.
Yeah, in Indiana, public schools have been allowed for some time now to teach that it's a scientific fact that a boy can turn into a girl or a girl can turn into a boy. And now they're getting much more authoritarian at making sure all of their teachers are on board with this. John Cruge was a teacher at an Indiana high school who was given three options. He could refer to some identifying transgender students in his class by their preferred pronoun. Mm. He could resign at the end of the school year, or he could be fired. Mm. Now, his religion would say that it was a lie for him to refer to a girl as a boy or a boy as a girl, so he wasn't taking option number one. And he didn't want to be fired, so he took the middle option and decided to resign at the end of the school year. There was some pushback by some of the local parents to try to get him to keep his job, but at the end of the day, the board voted to accept his resignation, setting a precedent now that pretty much any teacher, at least at that particular school district, who is unwilling to call a boy a girl or a girl a boy is no longer employable. And this is a trend that's rapidly taken off in America. We're going to have an article in the next print edition called The Tyranny of the Vocal Minority, just bringing out that in so many of these issues on abortion activist, homosexual activist, transgender activist, these are not positions that the majority of Americans are demanding. These are positions that you've got a very zealous, small but zealous minority that are enforcing new irreligious standards with the same zeal like the Puritans used to enforce the old religious standards. And because of the apathy of the general population, they're able to do that. You've only got a couple hundred thousand transgenders in the whole nation. And so it would not be common for a school teacher to come across somebody that is insisting that they want to be referred to as a she when they're not. But in the cases where it does happen, that is getting the full force of the law. In this case, being a public school, this is actually a government-funded institution that kind of like decades ago, they decided to force public school teachers to say that creation wasn't a thing. Evolution is the only accepted doctrine in America's government school system. Now even the existence of gender, of two genders that can't be swapped between, is something that you're just not allowed to say.
So biological reality is you're no longer allowed to acknowledge that, really. I think the point that you make about just the radical minority kind of dictating policy is a really significant one, especially because this is in Indiana. You know, Indiana's not a liberal state. They elected President Trump. You know, they voted for him. It's a Republican state, but yet this is happening even there. What do you make of that?
Right, because, I mean, similar incidences have happened in California, which is a little more expected.
Right.
But, yeah, Indiana, this is something that a fairly conservative state. Like I said, there's probably pretty small transgender minority that is just zealously advocating that you have to tell a five-year-old that he's a five-year-old boy, that he's a girl, or a five-year-old girl, he's a boy, if they've come under that delusion. And if you don't, you're fired. And so it's basically encouraging, like I said, encouraging a delusion, encouraging something that's just not true in a child that's way too young to even know what they're talking about, and could really mess someone up for the rest of their life.
Yeah, it's like if you want to appear enlightened and educated, you have to say that the emperor's new clothes are beautiful and shiny. You know, you can't dare come out and say he's not wearing any clothes. Could you please place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Yeah, well, there's definitely a number of prophecies throughout the Bible about moral decline in Isaiah about people declaring their sins proudly as Sodom, and that this is a something that not only will the sin exist, you could argue that some of these sins have existed for a long time, but they're now actually just being like championed and declared and made anyone who would dare say that they even disagree with them condemned as a bigot. And it is something that is enabled by the apathy of the majority. And we've got a book we can advertise in the show notes called Redefining Family that really does a wonderful job explaining the Bible's position on sexuality, for one, but also kind of explaining the history about how a very small, well-organized, vocal majority has kind of bullied the majority of the American people to believing things they would have considered ridiculous even 5 years ago, just because people have been apathetic and don't actually know what the Bible teaches like they would in past generations.
Yes, Redefining Family is just a very powerful booklet for anyone who wants to understand what's happening in the United States and in all of the Western world with these trends that are just gaining momentum so rapidly. So we'll be sure to have a link to that in our show notes. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial, and the live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we're going to talk about the ongoing migrant crisis in Europe, the geopolitical significance of Russia's hosting of the World Cup, the plague of suicide, and some very inspiring news about our own Herbert W. Armstrong College and our role in some earth-shaking archaeological discoveries. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. Last weekend, 630 people were rescued off the coast of Libya by a vessel called the Aquarius. This in itself was not viewed as extraordinary news, really, since rescues of this kind and in this region happen quite often. But the plight of these individuals ended up triggering a series of events that is deepening divisions in an already shaky and unstable Europe. To tell us about the latest chapter in Europe's migration crisis, we'll go once again to Richard.
So everything that I said in the last segment about Germany, it's this, think of that, but for all of Europe.
Mm.
That's basically where we are right now. This is a continent that is desperate for unity. Mm. There's been, the German foreign minister very famously tweeted after the G summit over last weekend, the solution to America first is Europe united. Mr. Trump is already putting trade sanctions, tariffs on aluminium and steel, and Europe wants to have a united response. They want to stand as a stand together, come together so that they can stand up to the United States, stand up to their interests in a chaotic world, and then in sails this boat.
Hmm.
And within days, all of that want of unity has just kind of fallen apart. So Italy said, nope, we're not accepting this boat. Typically, they've just gone and they've unloaded in Italy. Italy has then taken on a huge number of migrants, which is causing them lots of problems. They said, no. They said, well, you were closer to Malta when you picked up these migrants than you were to Italy, go take them there. Malta said, no, we're not having them.
So is that because of the new Italian government that we've talked about?
Yeah,
they're
absolutely
taking a firmer stance.
Their interior minister is the leader of the Liga, this fringe right, perhaps even far right party that rose to power on this anti-migrant stance. And so they're getting right into action with that, saying, nope, we're sending Europe a message. We're not going to accept these boats. So France very quickly started criticizing Italy. This caused a bit of a diplomatic tiff there. Mm-hmm. Eventually, Spain said, okay, fine, we'll take these migrants. We don't want them sitting in a boat for months. So they're now heading over, and they've got a new left-wing government. They're now heading over to Spain. But it shows the mess and the need for unity that Europe has right now. You know, there has been a lot of talk after these events last week about a Europe united. The reality on the ground is that they're not right now.
So normally on Trumpet Hour, the European stories are about efforts toward unification and about how, you know, Europe is becoming a conglomerate, a unified, even a United States of Europe, and just how that fulfills Bible prophecies. These divisions that you're talking about now, though, seem to speak to the opposite of that. Could you just maybe talk about how this will still lead to the unification that we're expecting?
Yeah. The Herbert W. Armstrong, the editor-in-chief of The Plain Truth, the Trumpet's predecessor, here's this great quote going back, it was from the 60s, where he's just talking about, look, we've been saying for 19 years that Europe is not going to unite. They haven't united. And he said, look, they will not unite until certain conditions have been met. He talks about, look, this is a big task. These are all individual, separate nations. Mm-hmm. The Germans are not going to very willingly say, oh yeah, French leader, come on, you lead us. The French are not going to be really enthusiastic about having a German leader in charge. The Italians, like you're seeing, do not want to be bossed around by the rest of Europe, do not want to be the dumping ground for migrants for the rest of Europe. And what Herbert W. Armstrong talked about in that article, and what Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerard Fleury has also talked about, is that it will take a lot of pressure to get Europe to unite. Even the Bible talks about this divided nature of this European power. It says there will be a European power, it says there'll be a measure of unity, but it also uses the metaphor saying it's like iron mixed with clay. It's something that you can kind of force together for a while, but it's not a natural mix. It's not a strong bond. And so what we're seeing in the migrant crisis is we're seeing just the raising of that temperature, the raising of that pressure that is going to force Europe to unite. And you know, as that process happens, then yeah, it's going to at times accentuate some of the divisions. Talking about a different pressure, the euro crisis, Mr. Fleury talked about, he said, this crisis is going to lead to people saying that the European Union is finished. Do not believe them, he said. And I think we can say the same thing about the migrant crisis. You know, as that pressure increases, it's going to put a lot of strain on Europe people. And one of the articles about this was talking about how this shows Europe is finished. Well, no, it's part of the pressure that's going to lead to that European or that united European power. Our free booklet, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast, is just a great place to get an overview of what the Bible says about that power. Some of those important scriptures that talk about what is coming, that gives you this even very nuanced picture with a lot of details about what is arriving in Europe. And then we can see some of those details in outline already. So read that book, and then that will really make a lot of this news come alive as we see the power forecast in the Bible assemble together.
Well, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on that, Richard. Well, the World Cup is underway in Russia right now. That's probably not news to anyone except for maybe many of our American listeners. But there is at least potentially quite a lot of geopolitical significance to the fact that Vladimir Putin's Russia is hosting this momentous international sporting event. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Anthony.
The World Cup is the biggest sporting event in the whole world. To our American listeners, it's way bigger than the Super Bowl. It's the biggest sporting event in Russia since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Billions will be watching these games, and they'll be going on for about 4 weeks. And at the end of this tournament, Russian President Vladimir Putin will present the coveted World Cup trophy to the winning team. And again, billions will be watching. Mm-hmm. Putin has spent 6 years working on this. He has spent more than $11 billion preparing for these games that will be hosted in about a dozen cities in Russia. And earlier in this program, we were talking about the legitimization of Kim Jong-un, the dictator of North Korea. And this World Cup really is also about the legitimization of another dictator, Vladimir Putin. But that's not all. One expert from the Carnegie Moscow Center said that Putin wants to show that Russia is a great power back on the global stage. People around the world would like it, and it can be isolated. So that's one of the results that we are likely going to see from this World Cup. Russia just showing how bold it is, how strong it is on the world stage. Maybe economically, it might not gain as much out of this World Cup, considering how much it is spent. Oftentimes, there is a lot of economic benefits to hosting such a World Cup. And there will be some, but I think the most significant benefit that Russia will get is this legitimacy, and then just showing the whole world that it is back on the world stage. A few months ago, the world was trying to isolate Russia, and there were some politicians, like the British Foreign Secretary, who wanted other nations to boycott the World Cup, but that obviously hasn't happened. So Russia is still going strong, and it likely will continue going strong. We have an article on thetrumpet.com. We'll have it in the show notes, and it just shows the history of Russia and sports, how it has viewed sports in the past. In fact, in the past, Russia didn't really appreciate Western-style competitive sport. It just considered them a tool of capitalism. But its leaders over time realized that they could take advantage of sport to advance their geopolitical victories. And it has been working for Russia. And the article goes into some of the history of those high-profile events. It talks about the UEFA Champions League in 2008, where Russia qualified into the semifinals. And later on, we found a more emboldened Russia invading Georgia. Something similar happened in 2014 when Russia hosted the Sochi Olympic Games. And not long after that, Russia annexed Crimea. So what can we expect to happen next? We don't know, but we do know that sport has this tendency of legitimizing a nation. It has a tendency of emboldening a nation, especially a nation like Russia, which has been really struggling under political sanctions and under a lot of isolation from the world. So it is important to keep watching Russia and how it comes out of this World Cup, because it is led by a very dangerous man that we have written about a lot here on The Trumpet.
Yes, this reminds me of something that The Trumpet's Mr. Brad McDonald wrote right when Russia was hosting the Olympics back in 2014. Just one paragraph from a really powerful article that Mr. McDonald wrote at that time says, "The 2014 Sochi Olympics are Vladimir Putin's declaration that the Soviet Empire has been resurrected. These Olympics are important to Putin because they embody and declare a powerful message about Russia and about Russia's president. Forget the athletes. The Sochi Olympics have been a two-week celebration of the muscle, ambition, and ruthlessness of Vladimir Putin." And I think that you could apply that exact, you know, that exact same analysis to the World Cup that is now happening. Would you be able to place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
The Bible does prophesy of a strong leader coming out of Russia. It calls him the Prince of Rush. And we have an article, we have a booklet actually about exactly that, and it's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia. So we'll have a link to that, and he is a leader that will unite a lot of Asian nations to form one of the biggest armies ever known to man, just as we mentioned a little earlier in the program. So look out for that booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. In recent weeks, there have been some high-profile suicides that have just really shaken many people. And these are just a small fraction of the suicides that are plaguing the American population in general in increasing rates. This really is just an epidemic. And to talk about this, we'll go once again to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, that is definitely a good word for it. Suicide is becoming an epidemic across America. The rates have increased 25% since 1999, and that's only about 19 years ago. Less than two decades ago, they've gone up 25%. And so according to a June 7th report by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, there's approximately 45,000 people killed themselves in 2016. Which makes suicide the 10th leading cause of death in America, roughly on par with about 42,000 who've died from drug overdoses. And there's definitely some overlap between those who commit suicide by intentional drug overdose. But that's a interesting comparison, is when you're looking at the cause of like, oh, why is this happening?
Yeah.
There's a very similar cause between the overdose epidemic and the suicide epidemic, which is family breakdown. The Center for Disease Control report found an interesting thing that said that less than half of the suicides that have a known cause were linked with a mental condition. So it's not necessarily people being crazy that's the leading cause. Actually, the leading cause was relationship problems. About at least 42% were due to some sort of relationship problem. And they had Christine Powers wrote an article in USA Today saying that the epidemic of desperation and despair in the Western world isn't caused by our brains. It's largely caused by key problems in the way we live. And then later on said largely disconnected from extended families, friends, and communities, the problem goes much deeper, and which would give a very strong correlation of why it's increasing so much, is that obviously over the past half century, divorce has become much more common. People who live on their own with no extended families get much more common. Loneliness used to be a problem that you normally associated with the elderly, people whose children have grown up and moved away and are living on their own or living in a home. But now they've actually done new studies to say that loneliness has become an even bigger problem amongst the under 30s, the millennial and the Generation Z generation, where you're just seeing that you've got just huge swaths of the American population that don't have that strong family connection that people were designed to have, and it's leading to depression and in increasing number of cases even taking your own life. And which is why for this program we're going to advertise in our show notes the God Family Vision booklet, which explains the actual value, like spiritual value between human life, the value God puts on it, but also more than that, explains the importance of the family connections that the Western world has lost so much of over the past half century, that our physical type of God's spiritual plan, and also fulfill some of those emotional and even spiritual needs that when you're deprived of, are leading to this suicide epidemic, which is really a symptom of much deeper underlying problems in Western culture.
Yes, that is the God Family Vision is just a profoundly inspiring book containing wisdom and truth that is a remedy for all the despondency and desperation that leads to so much self-destructive behavior that we see now. So we'll be sure to have a link to that in our show notes. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. Our final story today is about why some momentous archaeological discoveries that have implications for every nation and every person on Earth, are having their debut in quiet little Edmond, Oklahoma. Actually, just a few hundred feet from the studio where we are recording the Trumpet Hour right now. To tell us about these discoveries and the role of Herbert W. Armstrong College in them, and just the kind of publicity that all of this is getting, we'll go once again to Brent Noctegal.
It is quite remarkable just how much publicity we are getting over this exhibit. It's entitled Seals of Isaiah and King Hezekiah Discovered. They feature the two seal impressions of King Hezekiah from 2,700 years ago, biblical king, as well as his advisor, the prophet Isaiah, and they're in Armstrong Auditorium, as you said. And we did have, as most of our listeners know, a really successful opening last Sunday evening, a joint event here in Jerusalem that was simultaneously presented back in Armstrong Auditorium back there in Oklahoma. A number of people spoke at that. Mr. Gerald Flurry, the editor-in-chief of The Trumpet, he spoke, as well as Dr. Eilat Mazar, whom we work with, as well as former Ambassador Michael Oren, who's worked closely with Dr. Mazar in the early 2000s. And just today, we have received some quite favorable coverage of that event, and also going past that event, talking about the relationship that we have had for the past 50 years, going back to Mr. Armstrong's time, with Israel, with Hebrew University Professor Benjamin Mazar, and the excavations that took place in the aftermath of the Six-Day War here in Jerusalem. And so I just wanted to put a plug really in for these couple of articles, especially the one that was headlining the Times of Israel, one of the most prominent news papers or news websites over here for the English-speaking part of the country. This article is written by Amanda Borschel-Dan. She's their archaeology writer, I would say one of the best archaeology writers in Israel, covers a lot of the most important archaeological topics in a way that other people don't. She's only been writing the archaeology stories for about a year, but because she's kind of new to it, she's extremely thorough. And this piece that she did on the event itself, and also the relationship that we have with the Mazars and archaeology for the past 50 years, was just extremely thorough and amazing. It had amazing detail in it. It's 2,500 words. And again, this was at the front of the Times of Israel all day, and it's still on their front page today. So there's that article that I would go ahead and read up on. We can, of course, include that in our show notes. And then there was also another one in Breaking Israel News. They're more of a Israeli outlet that does focus on biblically significant news as they see it. And what was really great about that article is that you had quotes directly from the speech that Mr. Gerald Flurry gave at the opening included inside that article. And so to see the editor-in-chief of The Trumpet, the chancellor of the college and of the Armstrong International Cultural Foundation quoted directly in an Israeli news source talking about the hope that these bulle provide was extremely electrifying for me, and it will be for many of our listeners out there. That second article was entitled Beneath the Surface, The Untold Story of U.S. Christians Unearthing Israeli Archaeology. And so just some very favorable coverage. This isn't all that we're going to get from the Israeli press. There is some videos probably coming out next week about the event and the relationship. And so I know I've spoken for 4.5 minutes here without letting you speak, but I just wanted people to realize that the work that we're a part of over here in Israel is catching a lot of attention, and there are a number of people reading up about it, and the Israelis themselves are just impressed that we would be even more excited about their history and the archaeology of this land that in some cases they are. And so when you're so close to something, it's so easy to take it for granted. And sometimes you need an outside voice to remind you how important these things are and the archaeology and this history is. And that's what we've done. And the Israeli press is taking notice.
It really is very inspiring just to see these, you know, major publications calling attention, not just to these archaeological discoveries, but also to the fact that, you know, small Herbert W. Armstrong College back in Quiet Edmond, Oklahoma, was really instrumental in the excavation process, and just that we are now hosting this archaeological exhibition, this world debut of these really earth-shaking finds, and just to see these publications giving so much space to what Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Mr. Gerald Flurry has said about the significance of the way these are bringing the Bible to life, and even just all the history that they're documenting there about Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong and his relationship with Dr. Benjamin Mazar, and just how fruitful that relationship through the years has been, even coming up to the present with Dr. Elot Mazar and Armstrong College's ongoing relationship with her. So those articles are just very inspiring, and we'll be sure to include links to those. Typically, we only link to our own internal articles, but I think in this case, we'll definitely include the Times of Israel piece there and the other one. So please check out the show notes. If you just go to thetrumpet.com, you'll be able to find Trumpet Hour, and then in the show notes there, we'll have links to those articles. Thanks very much for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit us there to read more about the stories that we're discussing today and to subscribe to our print edition and our news brief, which we send out several times each week. Tell us what you think about the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to our panel today, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibadidwe, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And we'll leave you today with some words from Socrates. Employ your time in improving yourself by other men's writings, so that you easily gain what others labored hard for. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.